Good morning. Let's get started. My name is Erik Schnetter, and today will be a special lecture, same as yesterday. I'm going to introduce the Julia programming language and how you can install Julia on your laptop, and the actual content of the course starts on Thursday. And Mohammed told me that we haven't told you yet exactly how the course looks like. There's going to be four sections in the course, four particular topics: linear algebra, Monte Carlo methods, differential equations, and, please help me out, Mohammed.
Fitting models.
Fitting models, thank you. Yes, although that might change because Dustin looks a bit pensive here. And there are going to be three projects, and the grading of the course, well, the grading, the pass-fail, as I understand, is based on the three projects. There are going to be tutorials, and in these tutorials, you kind of start with the individual projects and later on to hand that in. Because this course is about numerical methods, it's about the skill you learn more than actually kind of a, whatever you want to call it, content that you learn. It's very difficult to design interviews where someone asks you a question and you respond. It is more important that you actually demonstrate that you can use this in actual projects. And it doesn't make sense to give you a project and solve it in 20 minutes in times of an interview. That is, the grading is based more on the projects that you finish. And I think last year during the interview, people asked you questions about the projects that you handed in, rather than you do something, maybe some coding or solve a problem in 20 minutes. That's just not how numerical methods work. You usually can't arrive at a solution in 20 minutes to any interesting kind of problem. Okay, now that I mentioned that, today I'm going to introduce the Julia programming language to you. And that will be in two parts. In the first part, I want to help you install Julia on your laptop if you're interested. Otherwise, you can also use Julia on our HPC system, Symmetry, that we have here at Perimeter. And Dustin fixed it yesterday, the thing that broke over the Christmas vacation. So we can now access Symmetry via the web interface and use notebooks there. I don't think you have accounts on Symmetry yet. That might happen until, I hope it's done, until the beginning of next week. And it might also be convenient to install Julia on your laptop. I see you all have laptops. May I ask you, what kind of operating systems do you have there?
Windows.
You're nodding. Most of you have Windows. I see a Mac over there. That's probably not Windows then. Okay, very good. Unfortunately, I don't have much experience with Windows, but let me begin by showing you how to install Julia there. So there's a website, julialang.org. You can't see it in the very top, as in Julia language. Please go there. And then on that webpage, you click the friendly green download button. And Dustin, did you tell people yesterday how to run something in a terminal? Okay, very good. If you scroll down, there's supported platforms. And there's official binaries for manual download. If you scroll down about halfway on the Julia download page, and there is an installer here that you can use. Huh, I don't know the difference between installer and portable. I'm more of a Mac person myself. And I think you would click here and then download it. So I want to spend the first 5, maybe 10 minutes of the lecture helping you to install that. So please do that now. And Dustin, Mohammed, and I can walk through the aisles and help you if you're stuck there. And if you already did that, if you find it boring, if you don't want to install Julia, tell me, and then we'll continue, and I'll give you a brief show and tell of Julia. If you already know to program and maybe already know Julia, that is boring. Apologies. But if you don't know Julia, these are the first steps that help you get started. And you will then continue in the tutorial today. So let's download Julia, and that would be the installer here. Okay, can I have some feedback? Did anyone click that? Is it working for you? Already done? Who is currently downloading it? Okay, very good. How long does it take? Is the network fast enough? Binary is probably a few hundred megabytes large.
Oh. Just said 4 hours.
Yeah, no, that's wrong. I mean, 4 minutes would be long. I'm glad that the website has a sense of humor. Okay, after you download it, you should be able to open it, and you should get a nice prompt with the command line where you can run something. And why don't you type 2 plus 3 in there, and I just check whether you get the correct result. How is the progress, Mohammed? Are they stuck?
Yeah.
Bored? Working?
Still working on it.
Still working on it.
Okay. Yeah, I downloaded it with the Windows Store type of thing.
Okay.
I think it works. So
Julia is a programming language that is interactive, a bit like Python or Mathematica. I guess you all know Mathematica. You might have heard of Python too. Julia has a few advantages when it comes to writing numerical methods. Certain things are more efficient or easier to do in Julia. Apart from that, the point is just that everybody here uses the same language. You could teach that course in Python as well if you wanted to. Okay. Oh, and whenever I'm teaching, if you have any kind of questions, complaints or something, if I forgot to make the font large enough, please interrupt me. There's no problem with that. Yes?
What's the advantage of Julia on Python?
The advantage is that if you want to write a code for numerical methods, then in Python, at some point, things become a bit slow, and Julia would be faster. So if you want to use the full power of the computer, run, say, on a high-performance computing system, then it's possible to do that in Julia. And in Python, that's usually not possible. The bits that need to run at full speed are usually called compute kernels. For example, they do simple things like a matrix multiplication or implement a PDE solver. And it's not possible to do that in Python while running at full speed. But I shouldn't say not possible, because there are extensions of Python that make that possible. But in Julia, it is possible. And say when it comes to running numerical applications on the largest supercomputers on the planet, people have done that in Fortran, in C, C++, and Julia. People have not done it yet in Python. The Python language is changing, right? There's new releases every year, so who knows how that looks like in 3 years. And the other large advantage of Julia, of course, there's a large community of Julia programmers, and many of them are interested in numerical method, and it just makes the language very convenient to use. Because whatever problem I encounter, there's probably 5 others who already encountered it, and they might have a solution or ideas in Julia. Okay, do we think that we can continue? Did you all type, say, 2 plus 3 and got 5 out? Okay, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to log into Symmetry and use Julia there. I'm briefly going to show you how to do that. You can't do that yet because you don't have an account yet on Symmetry. So I'm going to log into Symmetry via the web interface. And there are instructions that Dustin and Mohammed sent out yesterday. A first step that you have to do to set up Julia so that it works with the web interface. And after you did that, you see a Julia icon here. And when I click on that, a Julia kernel is going to start. I'm going to rename it. How do I do that? Is there a thing I can click? No. Double click, maybe. The red one. Do I click down here? Right click, rename. Sure, let's do that. Let's call it Julia introduction. The thing changed. And then here I can type 2 plus 3, and the result should be 5. At the moment, Julia is still starting up. That takes a bit of time. Oh, we are here. Very good. So I'm now going to get a brief introduction to the basics of Julia. If you already know how to program, that might be boring. Actually, Let me ask you, who of you knows Julia? You're supposed to raise your hand if you do. No one, okay. Who of you knows Python, C++, Fortran, any of that? Okay, very good. Most of you know how to program. Sorry, I didn't see that. Dustin, did you catch that? Is there anybody who wants to learn how to program, or are you all familiar with the basics?
I didn't.
Okay, sorry, I don't want to. Okay, who knows Python or some other programming language? I don't want to. Okay, seems to be everybody. Okay, so very quick going through that, the differences between Python and Julia mostly. So of course, 2 + 3 and so on, that is easy. You can ask for a type of an expression with type of, and you see it's round parenthesis. The syntax comes from MATLAB or Fortran. Yes?
Just one asking, if it's possible to clarify for students how to get the Jupyter notebook, because I see
I will post the Jupyter notebook on the web, or you will do that later on. And then whatever I type, you can look at later on. So you don't have to copy what I do. You can either follow along and type things yourself if you want to experiment with something, but you don't have to repeat anything that I do here on the screen. It shows the type, and 2 is int64. That's a 64-bit integer that has about 20 digits. And in Python, if I believe switches automatically to arbitrarily large integers if an expression would overflow. Julia does not do that. So if I calculate the factorial of 10, that is fine. And if I want to calculate the factorial of 100, there is an error message because that overflows. There is a thing called big integers. So you can write, say, big of 100. You don't see it in the output, but if you look at the type of, that is now a big int, that's an arbitrary precision integers, so you can have millions of digits if you want. And if I calculate the factorials with big integers, so first I convert 100 to big integers and then the factorial, then that works fine, and that thing has, I don't know, 200 digits or something. And there are also floating point numbers, of course, 1.0, type of 1.0. Can you read the bottom of the screen there? Probably is float 64. The other floating point numbers, float 32, float 16. Yes?
Sorry. In output 7, is that just like an approximation of 100 factorial?
No, that's exact.
Oh. I don't know why it happened. Why were we able to do that but not before?
Pardon?
Like, what does turning it into big integers?
Oh, these are different internal representations.
Okay.
int64 uses 64 bits always. That makes the code very efficient. But if something doesn't fit into 64 digits, into 64 bits, about 20 digits, there's an overflow. Sometimes overflow is detected, otherwise not. Julia chooses performance here over safety. That's not always good. But with big integers, you can have millions of digits. So that is not an approximation. That is always correct. Now, there are also numbers. For example, pi is, of course, pi. Actually, pi is just a symbol. When you use pi, it's automatically converted to the correct type. So you can, for example, write pi plus 1.0. This is now a 64-bit integer. You can also write pi plus big 1.0. That's a big float. That's a float with much more precision than just the usual 15 digits here. Then you get, well, 1 plus pi with, I think, 256 bits. That's about 80 digits. There are complex numbers, 2 + 3 IM. Complex numbers use IM for the imaginary unit. Just using I doesn't make sense. That's often a variable name. And you can also look at the type of this number. That's a complex integer. You can also have complex floating point numbers, whatever, 2.0 or something. That's now a complex floating point number. And Julia also has rational numbers. That's, for example, you write a double slash for that. 1/2 + 3/4 is that. And the type of that is a rational number. Mm-hmm. We have complex rational numbers, floating point, yeah. Oh, strings maybe. Hello is a string. That's not very surprising. And concatenating strings, you use the multiplication here. That's a weird choice. The idea is if you use the plus symbol, that's usually a commutative operation. string concatenation doesn't commute, so they chose the multiplication here because multiplication is not commutative, so that gives you hello world. Okay, that so far is pretty boring. Next, I'm going to talk about arrays and then control structures. Arrays with squared brackets, that looks very similar to Python. 1, 2, 3. You can add arrays, 1, 2, 3, plus 4, 5, 6. This adds them, arrays kind of form a vector space. So if you use plus, that adds them as vectors. You can also scale vectors. That works like that. But you cannot multiply arrays, because if you have a vector space, then you have a scalar multiplication, but you can't scale vectors. So this is by default not possible. You can also do element-wise operations with dot star and so on. This would be element-wise multiplication or element-wise exponential, for example, this squares the elements. Or you can apply some other function, sine dot. If it's an operator, it's dot operator. If it's a function call, it's the dot after that. That applies this element wise. I think in Python, if you use NumPy, certain things are automatically applied element wise. Julia is a bit more careful here whether you want to do it element wise or not. You usually have to specify that here. You can also concatenate vectors. Vectors like 1, 2, 3 are thought to be kind of a column vector. So if you want to concatenate vectors, the operation is VCAT, vertical concatenation. 1, 2, and 3, which is 1, 2, 3. And now comes the thing where the world is divided into two. It's like Emacs versus Vi. If you have a vector, for example, 1, 2, 3, and we want to look at the first element of that vector. The first element is the element 1, right? Because it's the first one. In Python, of course, array indexing starts from 0, and people either hate it or love it. Anyway, it's a totally small thing. Nobody cares about that. There are matrices, and I think most of things that are possible with NumPy, with np dot something, is also possible in Julia. Julia has a MATLAB history, so the syntax is a bit different, and the functions might be called differently. For example, there's a function rand n that gives a normally distributed, that is a floating point number drawn from a normal distribution. And for example, 3,3 gives a 3x3 matrix with floating point numbers drawn from a normal distribution that looks like that. And we can assign it to a variable, and works with a vector 2, and then we can multiply it A and X, which is a matrix vector multiplication. There's a transpose, which is just an apostrophe afterwards. And if we compare A to A transpose transpose, then the result should be true, obviously. Is there anything else interesting about linear algebra? Let me see. There's going to be a whole section about linear algebra. We will learn a bit more about efficiency and various algorithms. But I think actually solving a linear system might already be possible without loading on the package here. You see this one here? This is a backslash. You know, it goes from top left. So this is not A over X, it's A under X, right? So this is 2/3, which is 2/3. And this is 2/3, which is 3/2. It's a weird thing. We don't usually do it with real numbers, but real numbers commute, right? You wouldn't say 2/3, you would say 3/2, because you just commute 2 and 3. But if you have matrices, that they don't commute. So the syntax makes sense here. And this is A under X, like X over A, so to say. This is A inverse times X. So this solved the linear system here. That might be called linsolve in Python. And it's actually a bit more complicated. Is there anything else I want to show? Oh, there's a built-in help system. You can, with a question mark. Yes, left division operator. Does it talk about here, matrix division using polylog? Oh no, that's not it. Wow. Does that make sense? I wish that would be easier, but anyway, the examples are essentially what I said here. Okay, these are the small things. Now let's talk about, let me add a bit of a context here into this. Sorry, that's not what I wanted. Going to add something here. Here in the notebook, I can switch to Markdown. Does that work? And then I can give a title here. What title is this here? Call it Basic Operations. Nice. And now let's continue with some control structures here. So you already know how to program. I don't think you have trouble with that. This is just because the syntax in Julia and Python is different to help you get started. There are, of course, loops. So let's, for example, say access equals zeros of 10. This gives you an array of 10 zeros, and turn for I in 1 to 10. Access e equals 2 times I plus 1, and then we return this one. This gives you this one here. So this is how a for loop looks like for I in 1 to 10. There is no colon afterwards. Indentation is not important. Well, not for the language. It's important for me because I'm going to read your code. And at the end, you have to write end. It's similar to Fortran, MATLAB, and so on. And as I mentioned, error indexing starts from 1, not from 0. And zeros just gives you an array of zeros. It's a nice way to get an initialized array. There are, of course, also if statements. Let's make that a bit more complicated and add an if statement here. If I larger 5, there's no then and no colon. It ends with n. What are we doing here? There's an else. If I larger 2, else. And now we need to do something here. X is I equal I. I don't know. That's what I came up. Anyway, that's if, else, and so on. These are the things that you need. Of course, other things as well. There are things to, for example, exception handling and so on and so forth. If you're interested in that, I recommend the Julia documentation, which is fairly extensive. It's the main website. There is an introduction, Julia compared to other languages. There's a manual that you could read. There's base, describing the base library. That's really the fundamental things, the standard library, and so on, and developer documentation if you want to improve Julia itself. That's also possible. And importantly, in that language here, it's also a section about performance, how to make your code go fast. I said earlier, it is possible in Julia to write fast code, but simply converting it from Python to Julia won't make it go fast. There are a few things. For example, everything I showed you so far will not be efficient. Julia is a just-in-time compiled language. That is, anything I type here will not be interpreted or executed as in Python. Rather, it's first compiled and then executed. A small function here takes a small time to compile, I don't know, 10 milliseconds, you wouldn't notice. If you load a large module or write a large package, it can take a bit of time to compile, a few seconds or something. And if you have a large package, say a plotting package, there's about 100 dependencies on other things, then that compiling could take 2 minutes, and that can be inconvenient, because when you load a plotting package, you might have to wait a minute before things continue. But that only happens right when you load it, right? Later on, it would be fast. But the advantage is it's fast. Now, compiling happens function by function. So if you want to make your code go fast, you need to put it into a function so that the code can be compiled. I haven't shown you yet how functions actually look like. This is all straight line code. If you just experiment, that is fine. But if you find your code slow or anything is not working as expected, it's nice to put things into a function. So let me show you how to define a function. use the keyword function. And now what should our function do? You all know how to program. Should we look for prime numbers, or what do you want to do in the function? Choose. Nobody says anything. Is prime numbers too complicated? Do you think that would work? Could we do something easier?
Prime numbers are fine.
Prime numbers are fine. Anybody else agrees? Should we look for even and odd numbers instead? I don't want to bore you, and I don't want to do it. Okay.
Let's try regular numbers and then primes. Can we?
Okay. Let's write a function to count odd numbers and then or square numbers. Yeah, let's learn to count squares. So count squares, and it takes one argument n. We're counting the number of square numbers between 1 and n. And then we have a count. We initialize the count to 0. And now we loop over all the numbers from 1 to n for I in 1 to n. And now we need to check whether n is a square number. Here we kind of, how do we do that? Okay. We take the number I, we take the square root, we round, the square root will be a floating point number, then we round it down, or we round it to the nearest integer, and then we square it again. Is there a simpler way to do that? There probably is, yes. We take I, we calculate the square root, and then we round the square root to an integer, and then we check whether that is the same as the square root. Okay. To round to an integer, no, we just do that. We round like that. Then we have one more. I hope that it works. I did not prepare that. And then we return count. In a function, the last expression is returned. So I could just write count. That would also return count. Or I just write return count. It's more like that. And if you want to return nothing, kind of like return void in C or something, then you can also write nothing, which is just corresponds to void. But it's an actual value here, or return nothing. But here we return count. That's now a function. That's Julia has generic types. I'm going to talk to you about later. And function overloading. So you can define functions that accept specific types. And then you have several methods for the same functions. And depending on the argument types, different methods of that function is called. So for example, matrix multiplication, there is something that works with square matrices, there's something that works with rectangular matrices, something that works with floating point numbers, something that works with complex numbers. You also have matrices that only hold Boolean values 0 and 1, and they all have internally different implementations for performance. And this is one of the advantages of Julia that I didn't mention earlier, the type system. Python is an object-oriented language. And Julia is not. You cannot define objects. Instead, it has something that is more powerful, that is multiple dispatch. In an object-oriented language, you said you know Python. I just assume I can mention that without explaining it too much. You can have a type hierarchy. And depending on the actual object, say a parent class or a method in the base class is called. But the dispatch, that choice, which function is called, depends only on the object of which you call something. That's called single dispatch, because there's one object that chooses which function is called. And in Julia, there's multiple dispatch. So Julia examines several arguments to see what is called. Maybe that become clearer when I talk more about types and generic types later on. Let's try this out. Count squares. I like to do the what's it called? The special cases, the corner cases. So count squares 0 is 0, that's okay. Count squares 10, how many should there be? I don't know, 3 sounds right. 100, I expect that to be 10. Yes, very good. And you might be familiar with generator expressions, iterators, what are they called? Oh, the square brackets by your, yes?
So when you write something like for I in 1 to n, and when n is 0, what is the range of I?
It's empty. The loop never executes. Yes.
So it assumes that you have to go from to a higher number.
Yes, it starts by 1. You can also write something like this, and then it goes by 2s. That would be 1, 3, 5. Or you can go like this. So it would be 1, minus 1, minus 3, minus 5. And then n would need to be a lower number. Or like this. This would be a loop that counts downwards, if you want.
I see. So if you did something like this, then
it would be 1, 0, minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, and so on.
And if you do count squares as 0, then this will give you 1, right? Because 1 would be
If you put a 0 here?
No, if you do it like that, like 1 minus 1, n. And then if you run your count squares of 0, it should give you 1, right?
2. Oh,
0, okay. It counts 0 also as a square. Okay, sure, yeah.
Yes, okay. Anyway, I'll remove that again.
Yeah.
Good. I forgot the name, man. Anyway, let's write it like this. Count squares of n for n in 0, 10, 100. This count the squares for n and be varying n from 0 to 100 and going in steps of 10. So this count squares 0, count squares 10, count squares 20, and so on till count squares 100. That is a bit boring. And Julia also has tuples. Maybe it's more interesting if we return a tuple here. We return n and count squares n, then we see what actually is going on here. Okay, should we count primes now? Would that be useful? Or should I move on to the type system? That depends on how much experience you have in programming. And now I should probably move on because I also want to show you how to plot something in Julia. It's always nice to do a bit of plotting. And I think plotting is actually more important as a basic skill than the type system in Julia, although the type system is pretty cool. Okay, let's start with plotting now. Plotting. There are several plotting packages in Julia. One of them is called PyPlot. That actually just calls a Python interpreter to do the plotting and then returns the plot. So Julia makes it easy to call other languages. You can call code written in C, Fortran, C++, Rust, Python, other languages, and so on. So I think matplotlib is called in Python, and that thing is called PyPlot. There are other plotting packages. One of them is just called plots. That's probably the oldest one. The one I'm going to use is called Machia. Let me show you the documentation. And you should already be complaining because you can't read that. Is that readable? Jonathan? Dustin? Okay, you're sitting far in the back. So there's a website, machia.org, that explains all these things, how to do the plotting. But let me show you the basics here. So there is a package called WGL Machia. Machia is the package, and WGL, WebGL, that is a backend that outputs things in WebGL. And because I'm using a Jupyter notebook that runs over the web, this is convenient here. And I'm bringing this. No promises that it works. And now it's loading the package. You see the star here. That took a second. It was the pre-compiling. And what are we doing now? Let's plot some random numbers, right? Lines, points. Does that exist? Anyway, rand n. 5, 2. Does that work? Lines, points. Okay, just lines. Still a bit of compiling and thinking. What? Anyway, just a warning. I'm ignoring it. Here you go. Yes. So rand n gives random numbers, gives a 5 by 2 matrix. And Julia interprets this as the first column giving the x coordinates and the second giving the y coordinates. So it's 5 points, and these 5 points are connected by lines. I was trying to use lines points so that it would also make nice large circles here where the lines are, but apparently the command is not lines points, it's something else. You can go to the Machia documentation to figure this out. Let's make this more interesting. Let's do 100 points here, 101 points. That gives you 100 lines, I'm sure. And then it looks like that. And you see the range. I mean, most of the points are here near the origin, but some of them are a bit more outliers. That's because it's normally distributed numbers. The normal distribution is taken from a Gaussian, essentially. And if you want to plot, say, a function, say a sine function, you need to specify at which points you want to plot that. So as the x locations, let's take 0 in steps of 0.1 until 2 times pi. This is called a range. 6.2. Oh yeah, because, I guess because 2 pi doesn't divide into 0.1, it extends it to 6.2. Okay, and now we plot. Ooh, nice! Line segments, maybe it's like, oh, this autocomplete, I like it. XS and sine of XS. You remember the syntax, sine dot something? This is essentially a vector. It's a sequence, but it's essentially a vector. And this sine then is applied element-wise to all these points here. And then we should get a nice sine function to 6.2. It skips the last point. Okay, very good. And why is it dashed? I have no idea. Anyway, this afternoon you will also be experiment with plotting, and I'm sure you can figure out how to get nice axis labels there in a table and a legend, and to make sure this is not dashed, but actually has a nice line here. Okay, this was easier, this plotting. Okay, I cheated, of course, because I didn't install the plotting package. Let me actually show you how you were to install the plotting package. There is a package manager in Julia. It's built in Python. You probably have used conta or pip or some other package like that. This is called pkg. And if you want to add a package, sorry, I want to put it in here. Now, you need to use the package every time you use it, but you don't need to install it every time you use it. I'm just typing this once. So this is pkg.add, and then this package here. And this should actually install the package. That, of course, takes a bit. It's like a conda add, pip install, or whatever it is. And that takes a bit of time, and that installs it. Okay. There's a list of official registered Julia packages. You can register some of yourself if you write some. You choose the correct open source license, and then it checks there, and then would actually install it. No changes. Does that mean it's done? No, the star is still there. Yeah, no, that was boring. You know what? Let's make it interesting. We're removing the package. And then I'll add in, just so that you see what happens. And this is, of course, something that takes a bit of time, installing and removing. So these are other packages that are now also uninstalled because they are not used anymore. They are only used internally. And now let's add it again. Then we see what happens. Okay, while you're waiting, I have to say I'm quite happy that most of you know Python. When I started to teach numerical methods courses here, the parameter, it was about 10 or 12 years ago, it was a very different set of students. And many of them didn't know how to program, so about half the students didn't know to program at all. And that's why we had to start very slowly rather than teaching them the basics. I mean, it's not difficult. People would pick up Mathematica, but the programming here is a bit different. And that seems to have changed. I hope I'm not overestimating you. So if I'm doing something that goes over your head, you're not quite comfortable, feel free to talk to me either in private or ask questions or in a tutorial or something, because this is here for you to pick up to get started programming so that later on we can assume that you know how to program when we actually talk about numerical methods. Okay, that was that. It installed these things here. And of course, plotting is a huge topic. There are hundreds of thousands of functions you can call different things, heat maps and so on. Looks pretty cool. I recommend to go to the homepage of the Markier tool. And as I mentioned, there are other plotting packages. If you like these, if you're familiar with the Python matplotlib syntax, you can also use that. That might be easier for you to learn. And finally, in the last 15 minutes, I'm going to talk to you about the type system that Julia has. And this is the way you use it, probably the largest difference to Python. You already have seen types, for example, integers. Type of 1 is an integer, and you also have, for example, let's take a vector here. The type of that is vector of n64. Julia has generic types that is also called templates in C++, generics in Rust or in many other languages. In Python, that isn't really supported, and that means when you define your own type, maybe a structure or something, you can make it generic. Let's define a type here. Struct int point. Struct defines it's like a C structure. And then a point that contains integers. X is an integer. Y is an integer. End. And then, of course, we can end point 2, 1, 2. That's just, I don't know, just a 2D thing that we have here. Nothing special here. And this is how you call the constructor to get that point. This is an immutable structure. That is, you cannot modify it. If we write p equals endpoint, then p dot x is the x coordinate, but you cannot change the x coordinate because it's immutable. What you rather would do, you can declare mutable structures, but you would rather just, define a new thing where you do that. Now, this is a regular structure. We can also define a generic type. And in a generic type, you would have point of t with curly braces. That means there's a type argument t. And then x is of type t and y is of type t. And then when I write point 1, 2, well, I should write point int integers, point float 64, floating point numbers. And I think I can also just write point 1, 2. Yeah, then it deduces that it would be integers because both of the arguments are integers here. And this is a generic type, and this is one source of the efficiency that Julia has. In Python, you would define a class, and then the class has certain members. But the types of the members are not known ahead of time. And that means at runtime, the interpreter needs to check what types the class members have. And in Julia, when you write a function that takes a point, when you call the function, then you know what type the point has and can write efficient code. Let me give you an example. Function, what would you do? Let's write add, right? P is a point of type t, and q is a point of type t. So both need to be points with a generic type, then where t, and then we return a new point. Add the return statement just for clarity. This is a generic function, and then we can add point And we can call add again with, say, floating point numbers here. And what Julia has done internally, it looks like it's the same function, but Julia compiled that function twice. Once for integer points, and once for floating point points. And that means these functions are super efficient. Each of these functions is just a few machine instructions long. That is, these functions run in nanoseconds instead of what Python would do, probably on the order of microseconds. And of course, when you write that function, you don't, it's not really, doesn't add that overhead, right? You don't write multiple versions of these functions. It's just you write the function in a generic way. You could even write this function in a simpler way if you leave out all the T things, and Julia would figure it out by themselves. So the way you would actually write this function, I just added that for clarity, is you would write it like this. And that would still be efficient because Julia would figure this out. And we can actually look at the machine code that is generated for do that. We can write add code native and then add this function call here. And this shows you the machine instructions that Julia generates for this function. Don't expect you to read that. So these greenish bluish things are the machine instructions here. And these ones that add with V, these are actual instructions. Move, actually, this RSI is a pointer to memory. It loads a value from memory into one register. The register happens to be called XMM0. That's the add instruction where something else is loaded from memory and then added to XMM0 and stored in XMM0. And then XMM0 is stored in memory where the result is expected. And we can also do that for the other function. And then you see that that other function, sorry, if you call it with integers, you would see slightly different instructions. Oh, wow, no. There is now a Q instead of a PD here. You don't see the difference. Okay, apologies, that is closer. Julia also optimized the code. You see in one add instruction here, if you look at the function here, you see there were two add instructions here. The modern CPUs support SIMD vectorization. It means single instruction, multiple data. SIMD, that is a single machine instruction, can perform up to four operations here. It does two add operation with a single machine instruction. So, I mean, that code runs about as twice as fast as you would naively expect. There is a lot to say about generic programming and multiple dispatch. I don't want to introduce here because I planned this lecture as just an introduction to Julia. If you're interested in that, that is, of course, beautifully described in the Julia documentation, because this is one of the main differences that is visible to others, difference to Python, C++, and so on and so forth. Okay, do you have questions so far about Julia? Comments, complaints?
So Julia is a functional language, correct?
You can call it a bit a functional language, yes. It's not object-oriented.
Yeah, so yes. It's not generated?
No.
Okay.
Now, of course, everything that you write in an object-oriented language, you can still write in Julia. On object-oriented language, you would call something like as an object, object.function, and then you pass the arguments.
Yeah.
And in Julia, oh, sorry, didn't mean, you would write fun.object x, y, right? You would pass the arguments in a different order, and then it's essentially the same. But it's not really object-oriented. Mm. Okay, if you have no questions, I also want to drift off a bit into a computer science direction. There is a very old language, the second oldest language, Fortran being the oldest, around since about 1959, called Lisp, which stands for list processing. And it's a really powerful language for symbolic manipulation. The powers of Mathematica, for example, I mean, on the outside, nobody knows what there is, but under the hood, Mathematica is essentially a variation of this Lisp language. And that makes it very easy to implement symbolic manipulation, right? I mean, how you take a derivative, simplify function, and so on. In Mathematica, you have this tree of expressions. Julia is also based on Lisp. I don't think you can do it here, but if you call Julia on the command line, you can, I think, give it a dash Lisp option or something, and then you're dropped into a Lisp interpreter instead of Julia itself. It's just a cool thing for nerds. You don't need to worry about that. But the same thing happens here, and one of the powers of Lisp is that when you have an expression such as 2 plus 3, you get access. You cannot just evaluate it, but you can actually get access to that expression as well. So for example, you can write quote 2 plus 3 and end. And the result is the expression 2 plus 3. You can also write it with a colon and parenthesis. You get 2 plus 3. And we can also look how that looks internally, which is as a dump function. So there is an expression object, and the head of the expression object is kind of what you would call zero. The zero thing in Mathematica is the symbol call, because it's a function call. And this call thing has three arguments. First, plus, because it calls the plus function, and then two arguments, 2 and 3, which happen to be 64-bit integers. In this quoting here, we can do that with things that are undefined. For example, if I write, for example, B, I don't think I use B. Yeah, it doesn't work. So it doesn't exist, but we can write 2 plus B. And this is just the expression 2 plus B. And you can look at that. And we can have more complicated expression, for example, 2 plus B times C. That looks like this. So there's one expression, which is 2 plus, and the second argument is another expression. And of course, the nice thing is that here, if you have parentheses here in the usual syntax, once you write it as a tree, the parentheses vanish, right? The top level is the multiplication. The first argument to the multiplication is 2 plus b plus 2b. And the second argument to the multiplication is c, if you look at the indentation here. And of course, if you have access to that, you can import any kind of expressions, you can manipulate expressions, simplify them, calculate derivatives, and so on. Now, historically, the focus of Julia has been on numerical work, not on these kind of symbolic evaluations. So there is a package called Symbolics that allows you to do symbolic manipulations, but it's far behind Mathematica. So Mathematica is really easy to use. You have, I don't know, 30, 40 years of experience with that, and Julia much less. But the underlying engine is the same thing. And sometimes when you write code, when you do something, that is really useful. For example, that sounds a bit crazy now. I'm currently working on a project designing a real-time data analysis pipeline for a radio telescope, Quart. Oh, it's cool. Let me just show that off. Quart Observatory. It's built in. This is not a picture. The dishes aren't there yet. Some of the dishes will be built this summer. These are 512 dishes. I don't know. The picture doesn't have 512 because 512 is not a square number and it looks kind of square. Anyway, there are going to be 512 radio dishes, and the sample signals from the sky, and they need to be processed, Fourier transforms, and so on. And I am using Julia as a language to do that. And the respective code to process the data is complicated, so I didn't want to write it myself. Rather, I write Julia code that then writes the code that analyzes the data. If you want to analyze the data efficiently, then the respective code, I don't know, you need to do complex array indexing, and it's quite repetitive, and so on. And of course, everything runs in CUDA, so maybe you want to do something with different threads and different warps, and so on. And it's convenient to use Julia as a language and then generate the code using expressions like that. And these expressions are later passed on to the Julia compiler, who compiles it as the respective CUDA code. And then we capture that code, store it on disk, and the data analysis pipeline then uses and runs that code. And that would be much more difficult to do in other languages. Python has a thing called SymPy, where they do all that symbolic manipulation, but they had to implement all that from scratch. In Julia, it's built into the language. Okay, that is kind of the end of my lecture today. Do you have questions, comments? Stuck with something, want a bit more help getting started with Julia?
Yeah, I think practice with syntaxes will help a bit, because something was a bit confusing.
Okay, what was confusing?
But I think like if we would read the documentation would be like better.
Okay.
It depends on how hard is approaching.
Okay. Yes. Well, as a graduate student, I want you to try to do it by yourself. And my office is 350-350, or you can send me email, ask questions all the time. And I'll also be there in the tutorial this afternoon. And the tutorial will be 2 bits. The other important skill is using Git and version control. So there'll be something on that. And there'll also be a task where I ask you to do something with Julia, just to make sure you do the basics. It's none of the complicated symbolic manipulation thing. Very good. See you in the afternoon.